Okay, we're here. This is From Sinai to Manhattan 3, third class. What do we call the body of information that was passed along? I'm just giving it away. Orally. That provides all these explanations for all of these rules and laws in the Torah that are not really so clear on their own. That's the oral tradition. What was an example we gave throughout, an example of the oral Torah's filling in the gaps? It's tefillin. All it says in the tefillin is bind them as a sign upon your arm and a total foot between your eyes. Where do you get the black boxes? Where do you get the leather straps? Shabbat. What was the example we gave in Shabbat? What's that? You gotta stop eating this unhealthy food. I had three boxes of I don't know what I just ate before I came here. What was it? Shabbat. It says in the Torah, Shamar v'Zachor et Yom. Right. Remember the Sabbath to make it holy and guard the Sabbath. So what does guard the Sabbath actually mean? Before you ask a question, what does guard the Sabbath actually mean? It could mean a million things. That's the point of the oral tradition, comes to teach that it refers specifically to the 39 activities that went into the building and the maintenance of the tabernacle, of the Mishkan, and those are the 39 activities from which we refrain from to this day. Why? The Torah doesn't say don't do these 39 things. The Torah just says don't do work. But if I went around the room here and I asked everybody how you define work, you would say the physical exertion of labor. You would say expending energy. You would say my job. Everybody would say something else. If we just followed the Bible alone, we'd have just a lot of unemployed Jews hanging around on Saturdays. We wouldn't really have Shabbos as we know it. So these are very, very good examples of filling in the gaps. And then we talked last week about how was this information then passed down from generation to generation. How was it passed down if it was never written down? We discussed this at length last week. If you look on page of your handout, 3, 4, and 5, we read together Maimonides, who describes the repetition of the oral tradition passing down from generation to generation. I want you to turn to page 7 now. Because this oral tradition did not stop with the Jews in the wilderness. Remember that Moses, when he would hear an oral tradition from God, would share it with his brother Aaron, and then Aaron's two sons, Eleazar and Itamar, would come in, and they would hear it, and then the 70 elders, and then the rest of the people. What about for the next few centuries, after the Jews finally were liberated, entered the promised land, rather? And they came into Israel. And then we were kicked out of Israel. Look at page 7 of your handout. This is a photocopy from a book written by the late and great Aryeh Kaplan. Has anyone ever heard of Aryeh Kaplan? Really, really amazing books. If you want to fill your Jewish library up with books that are awesome, deep, but simple, Rabbi Aryeh Kaplan. And he wrote a book, many different books, and I just photocopied. This is the chain of the oral tradition. From Moses, look at number 1, number 2, Joshua, 3, Pinchas, and the elders, Eli, Samuel, these are the elders, and then the prophets. And then after the prophets, you had the Anshei Knesset Hagdola, the great assembly, that's 22 and 23. Mordechai, just to give you a little punctuation mark, Mordechai in the Purim story was a member of the Anshei Knesset Hagdola, the men of the great assembly. Then you had what's called the Tanaim. The Tanaim were the ones who authored what's called the Mishnah. Don't worry if you don't get all this. The Mishnah is the starting of the writing down of the oral tradition. We talked about last week how it wasn't supposed to be written down, but at some period it was necessary anyway to write it down. Rabbi Yehuda HaNasi did that. He took all of the writings of the Tanaim from 24 through 35, and then the Amoraim were the sages of the Talmud from 36 through 40. Ravina Ravashi were the ones who actually did the final edits on the Talmud as we know it today. And then after them, you had the Savarayim, the Gaonim. You ever hear of Sajagon? Great rabbi, he lived in the Gaonic period. The codifiers, like the Rishonim. Rashi was a Rishon. These are just different epochs and times on a Jewish calendar. When did Rashi live, for example? The great biblical commentator Rashi. He lived in the 1000s. He was in the Rishonim period. The 1000s to like the 1400s were approximately the Rishonim period. And afterwards come the Achronim. These are just different sages passing down the oral tradition from generation to generation. By the way, they're not just passing it down. What's really keeping Judaism alive throughout the ages? And if I went through what else was going on, how much persecution and anti-Semitism? pogroms and crusades and Cossacks and inquisitions were going on while all this was happening. It's an unbelievable thing that we have so much clarity, even though we have some debates and discussions and we've lost some traditions, I've said. But how much knowledge and wisdom that we still have. Do you know that Rashi himself, who lived in the 1000s, where was he from?
Germany.
He was from Germany. Now Rashi... No, opposite. Rashi was from France. He went to Germany as a young man because when you're a budding Torah scholar, where do you go as a young man? Today also as a young woman. Where do you go?
Sure.
You go to synagogue, but why would you travel to another country?
You would be scholars.
You want to go where all the scholars are. What happens in America today after kids finish their Jewish day school experience? High school, where do they all go for a year or two or three? They go to Israel. Why do they go to Israel? Because there's more Torah in Israel than there is in America. It wasn't always like that. My 12th grade Rebbe in high school, he was from the Lower East Side. They sent him to Poland. They sent him to Poland because that's where all the big Torah scholars were. So where did Rashi go? He went to Germany because the biggest Torah scholars were in Germany. At that time, in 1,000 years ago. Rashi thankfully came back to France. Had Rashi not come back to France, you know what happened to all those rabbis that Rashi studied under in Germany? They were all wiped out during the First Crusade. We talk about this on Tisha B'Av. And had it not been, Rabbi Soloveitchik writes this, had it not been for Rashi returning to France to rebuild and to bring all this Torah information, knowledge, and wisdom to a new Torah center, France, all of the oral tradition, says Rabbi Soloveitchik, would have been forgotten and lost, because we lost a lot of the writings of the great rabbis of Germany. But Rashi absorbed so much, and he brought it to France. And what became the next great Torah center in the world? France. Where is it today? It's Israel, I think. America is probably a number two. Maybe 30, 40 years ago, America was probably number one. But things have changed. You know, just different trends in Jewish history. It's kind of interesting.
Say 30 years ago?
Probably 30, 40 years ago, Israel was not as developed. There weren't as many rabbinic sages and leaders. There were probably more here. And today, it's going the other way. It's just about 10 years ago that Israel actually became the number one Jewish population in the world. There used to be more Jews in America than in Israel. There are now more Jews in Israel. So things are actually changing. So I'm just giving you a little sense of how this gets passed on. Does everybody know when it was finally written down? When was it finally written down? And who remembers why? You don't have to give me the when, because that's dates. You're not responsible for dates. Why did they finally start writing down the oral tradition?
They feared it would be lost.
Okay, what was happening in the Jewish community that people were nervous they're going to start losing the traditions. They're going to just forget things.
Persecuted?
Well, we were always persecuted. Which one? I hate to say it. What was happening in the Jewish community specifically? Destruction of the Second Temple. The Jews were being exiled, scattered amongst the globe, learning different languages. Hebrew started Jews started forgetting Hebrew. And therefore, one rabbi took it on his own. What was his name? I need you to know his name for this class. Rabbi? Guys, I'm telling you, really take notes. This is such a... I can't encourage you enough. You don't have to write down everything. Just get the basics. This way you'll be able to come to this. I want to build on it every week. His name was Rabbi Yehuda, or Judah Hanasi. He was called the Prince. And he was an awesome, awesome scholar. And he wrote down a book called the Mishnah. M-I-S-H-N-A. You got to know that word. Really important word for you to know. He wrote down the Mishnah. What's the Mishnah? The word Mishnah just means review. He just started writing down the basic rules and laws so people would not forget. Who knows what that served as the basis that it ultimately developed into? The Mishnah ultimately developed into the Talmud. What's another word for Talmud?
Gemara.
The Gemara.
I'm going to show you quickly. A little exercise after all this.
It was Dipsy Doodles. I ate 3 bags of Dipsy Doodles. I'm sorry. So, here. This is a Talmud. And you don't need to be a Talmud scholar to study Talmud today. You know why? Because of Rabbi Hartzfeld. Hartzfeld came along, and you could open up, and look at this. This is the tractate. I randomly pulled out a tractate, Blessings.
A lot of chapters in Blessings. It's a lot of, right? And it says here, I'm just going to read it. Here's the Mishnah. Shlosha she'achlu ke'achat. 3 people that are eating together, chayiv lezamin. They are obligated to do what's called the zimun. You ever been at a long-winded rabbi's meal? Finally, they finish the meal. You get to go home. No, we got a bench now. We have to say thank you to God for the food. And there's what do you hear before we start the benching?
Sighs.
Everyone's looking at their watches. I want to go home. What? Okay, on Shabbat they sing Shiyir HaMalozen. Alright, after that song,
an invitation to bench.
There's an invitation to bench, which is called, okay, what is that called? A Zimun. If you're in Israel and you get called to the court, it's called Hazmana. It's a subpoena. You're being called. Or nicer, if you get an invitation to someone's wedding, it's like, you know, also. So, and how do we know that 3 men are sitting together? They have to invite each other to bench. Rabbatai Nevarech, gentlemen, let's bench. There's also mezumenet for women too, by the way. We talk about that another time. I studied that with my daughter last year. And all the rules and laws about benching having to do this and the other is found here. But it's just a bunch of rules and laws. And here's the text. Okay, it's written in, Mishnah was written in Israel, and therefore it's in Hebrew. Where was the Talmud actually written? The Talmud was written over the next 300 years. Where? Babylonia. And they spoke Babylonian? They spoke Aramaic. So Aramaic was actually, this was written in the vernacular. So, you know, when you grow up going to yeshiva, or when you get to yeshiva soon, you know, they told you about that after Fellowship 1. Yeah. Okay, so you'll learn how to read Aramaic. It's the same letters as Hebrew, and the Talmud basically elaborates, and it's the oral tradition written down. Very, very important. Okay, now, yes, let's take some questions. And Daniel, you had a question first, and then we'll take yours.
Does the word totefot mean anything without the oral Torah?
It means phylacteries.
But what does that mean?
Who knows? No, I mean that. It's like, they have these English words. You open up these Bibles, Hebrew Bibles, Christian Bibles, very unhelpful, vague words that they come up with, and they're not really great. I mean, do you realize, you know why some people to this day still think that Jews have horns? You ever hear this crazy thing, Jews have horns? Anybody know where that comes from? Because when Moses came down from Sinai, after the Torah was given, and he was there for 40 days, 40 nights, the Torah says that his face shined like a Karen ore, like a light. But the word Karen was also could be translated as a horn. It's a mistranslation within the context of what it's discussing. So some people say, oh, Moses had horns. He had a horn. He came down with a horn. No. He was shining, so much so that the Torah continues to say he had to put a mazveh on his face. He had to put a mask because the people couldn't contain. Something happened to Moshe on Har Sinai for those 40 days, 40 nights. He was still a human being, but he spent 40 days with God studying Torah. He was God's study partner. And he was glowing. But it gets mistranslated. Everything in our lives as Jews comes down to the way you understand the Torah. And if you don't have the oral tradition and you're left with a simple English translation, you know, or you just read it literally. There was a group, you ever hear of the Karaites? Karaites were a group that rejected the oral tradition. They only believed in the written law. So they sat in the dark on Shabbos. Why? Because the Torah says, Lo tavaru esh b'chol moshevotechem. On Shabbat, I shall not kindle a flame in all of your precincts. But if you read it literally, it could sound like, on Shabbat, there shouldn't be any light. So they sat in the dark. We know we're not allowed to make light on Shabbos. We can't create a fire. We can't turn the light switch on. But if we do it before Shabbat, then it's fine to have light in our home. In fact, it's a mitzvah to have light in your home. We get to our Shabbos series soon. Why do we light candles every Friday night? It's to have illumination in our home. There's a mitzvah to have light in your home. Just not allowed to do it on Shabbos. But the Karaites had no oral tradition. They didn't believe in the oral tradition. They rejected that. So during a period of time when a woman is in nida, during the period of menstruation, they were living in different homes. There's no Jewish tradition for husband and wife to separate during the period of menstruation of a wife, and absolutely not. But they were reading it literally. We are not fundamentalists. And if you become one, which I'm not telling you not to do, everyone that gets to choose how to live their own lives, but you're going to have a lot of issues and problems with science, because you're going to start reading the Torah, the Bible, literally. And sometimes the Torah is meant to be read literally, and sometimes not. But what does it mean, love your neighbor as yourself? Can you really love your neighbor as yourself? And the Torah also says you shouldn't be jealous of other people. Is it possible for a human being to control their emotions, not to feel jealous of other people? What does the Torah mean? This is what we do. And that's why when you go to a yeshiva or a school for advanced Jewish studies, they're spending most of their time studying Talmud. Because Talmud opens up all of the secrets of the Torah. The Torah itself is not an understandable document on its own, on its face. It needs some kind of code, and that's what we understand as the oral tradition. Now, I want to get into something else tonight, and that is, where do the rabbis... Oh, you had a question. I'm sorry.
What's the difference then between
Okay, guys, so the difference between Mishnah and Talmud, Mishnah is just, any lawyers in the room, it's like black letter law, it's what the stuff you have to study for the bar, I remember. It's just law, law one, law two, law three. It's not much conversation, it's not much analysis, it's not much application. The Talmud now takes all of the laws of the Mishnah, rips them apart, extrapolates from them, analyzes them, and applies them to real life situations with cases, case studies. So it's really a beautiful development. Has anyone actually studied a little Mishnah Talmud? It's very hard for me to do justice to it. It's a beautiful, sophisticated way to really understand Jewish law. So that when someone tells you, oh, by the way, you're not allowed to do this on Shabbos, or you're supposed to do that, didn't you know that? As a Jew, the real way to do this is not simply follow what the rabbi says. It's really like, where'd you get that from? Who told you? Oh, well, there's a verse in the Torah that said, well, how do you know how to read the verse? Well, look at the Mishnah, look at the Talmud, and not only that, you look at all of the different commentators on the Talmud to try to make sense, and you master law, and you understand it, so it doesn't sound like this made-up, arbitrary thing. A lot of Jewish law and halakha, for a lot of people, sounds made-up and just arbitrary. It just sounds like a bunch of random bunch of laws that we're supposed to do because we're Jews. But what the Talmud really does is it explains, here's the verse, here's the way it's understood. And by the way, it's not always so black and white, especially how to apply the law sometimes in modern times. We're going to give some examples very, very soon, starting next week.
I have a very good question.
Yes, please.
Does Koren make Talmud?
Koren has a whole translation of the Talmud. Yeah. First one to actually translate the whole Talmud into English was Cencino. I had that when I was a kid. It was okay. It was hard. Old English. I felt sometimes I was being punished because I was cheating. Because the rabbis never wanted us to really use like the Cencino. Also, Adin Steinsaltz, it's an unbelievable thing. He translated the entire Talmud, one man. He wasn't even raised religious or observant or knowledgeable. Just a genius of a man from Russia. And... So there were a few before. Art Scroll is probably, in my opinion, it's just the most user-friendly. You really don't have to know anything about anything Jewish, and you can open up any page of Talmud and actually understand what's going on. I mean, you have to focus a little. It's not simple. It's not like bedtime reading kind of thing. By the way, I want to mention one thing. If anybody wants to come with me on January 1st, this is a weird thing. There are going to be 100,000 Jews in MetLife Stadium celebrating the 7-year cycle of the completion of the Talmud, which I'm doing. And I've bought 28 tickets. It's called the Daf Yomi, which you study 2 pages of Talmud a day. And it's a very realistic thing. If you just study like 2 pages of this every day, then in 7 years, you can finish the whole Talmud. Okay, so not everyone who's there did the whole thing, but a lot of people. If anybody wants to come, I have some subsidized tickets. You talk to me privately. We're going to bring some people. I went 8 years ago on the last one, and it was awesome, really awesome. Like, to actually pray with 100,000 Jews is an amazing thing. January 1st, it's a Sunday, MetLife Stadium. Okay, I should really do commercials for that. All right, now, I want to mention one other thing. So in the year 188 CE, a great rabbi by the name of Rabbi Yehuda Anasi published a final redaction of the Mishnah, and then the Talmud was developed based on that. And after the Talmud was completed, if you look at page 7, you had the Sevarayim, who made additions to the Talmud, and then you came the Gaonim, who lived in the year 1038 CE. They headed up the great academies in Babylonia. These were the accepted centers of Torah. Their decisions were based on the traditions of the masters of the Talmud. And it went on and on and on, and it continues on to this day. It just continues and continues on to this day. I want to share two passages with you on page 8. Any other questions about this? Any other questions?
How do things get added?
That's what I want to discuss right now. I want to discuss that now. The way things get added, very simply, is that new applications for old laws. So next week, I think we're going to start next week, we're going to talk about the case of the Dicephalus twins. I want to give you real live examples of how we use the halacha in modernity. So there was a story of these babies that were joined at the chest, and the only way to save one life, because they would both die if the doctors didn't do anything, was actually to take one life in order to save the other, which is forbidden. But there was a whole discussion, it went to one of the great rabbis of our generation, Moshe Feinstein. I want to study what his analysis was, how he took a verse from the Torah, the Mishnah, the Talmud, the commentaries, and came up with a real live answer. And that's the way it continues to develop into this day. Modern technology, fertility breakthroughs that we have, which are unbelievable. All sorts of new things. Electricity. How old is electricity? So how do you take the laws of Shabbat, the principles that you have in the tractate of the Talmud of Shabbat, and apply it to electricity? Is turning a light on Shabbat the same thing as operating my microwave? Or what about getting in a car that's combustion? Isn't that different than getting on a train, you know, just swiping my card? Like, that's how it continues, really. It continues if we choose to apply those principles to our everyday lives. And it's not always black and white what the answer is. And two Jews, three opinions. You might go to two rabbis and they give you two different opinions.
But does it get added to the book?
No. Well, in a sense, yes, because we keep writing new books. The Talmud stays the Talmud. It's got all the principles in it. But there are these things called tshuvot, which we're going to study next week and the week after, the responses. And that's what rabbis continue to write. When I say rabbis, I don't mean Rabbi Joe Schmo, Mark Wiles, Manhattan Jewish Experience, or Rabbi Blah Blah from the Young Israel of Hudi Hudi. I mean like your two or three great rabbinic sages of the generation. They write a few books where they analyze the big issues of the day. Cosmetic surgery, we're going to talk about that also. All these things were not known when these principles were laid down, but we know how to apply them today by studying them ourselves. And by the way, if you become enough of an expert in the principles, then you can do this yourself. The goal is not to simply have rabbis who have all the answers and the rest of us sit here and wait for them to tell us what to do. The goal in Judaism is to become a scholar. There's no such thing as a layman in Judaism. That's why I hate the term like philanthropist. Like implies those are the people who give money to charity and everybody else watches. No, everyone is supposed to give. You just can't give the same. And maybe not everyone is a towering scholar, but we become more learned. We become more knowledgeable. That's a very important Jewish tradition. Now, I mentioned something last week that I want to go over because I didn't get a chance to talk about it enough. Was every single verse and phrase in the Torah explained? No, there were certain things that were left unexplained. And I mentioned something with the number 13. Does anybody remember anything that I mentioned last week with the number 13?
Hermeneutical,
thank you very much. Does anybody know what that's referring to? Remember, do you remember last week I said that if I can lift this, where's my tape recorder? If I can lift this tape recorder, if I can lift my phone and it's heavier than the recorder, then kal v'chomer. Chomer means hard, heavy. Kal means light. If I can lift 20 pounds, then kal v'chomer, Wilds can lift 10 pounds. Right? It's one of the 13 hermeneutical principles which we believe God gave over to Moses at Sinai to be given to the leading rabbis of every generation to interpret the biblical text where there is no such tradition, where there wasn't a handed down one, like tefillin have to be black or a certain, you know, leather or whatever it is. But who what's the governing body called that does that? They are called the Sanhedrin. Who can tell me when the first, how many people are in the Sanhedrin of every generation? 71. There always needs to be odd because it's majority vote. 71. Who convened the first Sanhedrin? Moshe, whose advice did he take? You remember the story?
It was put together your like judges or advisors or something.
Yeah, who gave him the idea?
Joshua?
His father-in-law, Yitro, saw his son-in-law after the Torah was given standing with long, long lines. Yeah. Why were there long lines after the Torah was given? Standing waiting to hear from Moshe.
Because he was the only
one. He was the only one. You got to delegate. You got to delegate. So he appointed the top 70 scholars, and he was the 71st. Every single generation from the time of Moses until the Romans destroyed our second temple, we had a Sanhedrin. Now, we don't have one anymore. The Sanhedrin were given authority to do two things. This is really important. And this is what sometimes gets us into divisions between the different denominations, specifically the Orthodox and the Conservative. Okay, you with me? They were told they could do two things. Use the 13 hermeneutical principles to interpret the biblical text to arrive at halakha. And you can actually create laws. And those laws that they can create are called rabbinic law. In Hebrew it's called midrabanan. Biblical law in Hebrew is called midoraita. Or you can just do biblical and rabbinic. Let's keep it simple. So the rabbis of the Sanhedrin had two powers. They can interpret the biblical text using the 13 hermeneutical principles to arrive at halakha. And by the way, when they arrive at halakha using those 13 hermeneutical principles, does that halakha have biblical or rabbinic status? Keep going. It's biblical, because what are they doing? They're interpreting the biblical text. They're not making stuff up. They're just taking a verse in the Torah. I'll give you an example. How do we get married? You hire a rabbi and he knows. That's not, we're done with that. This is fellowship, man. The ketubah is not what marries you. The ketubah is not what marries you. You don't get married through the ketubah.
So you're giving something of value.
You have to give something of value. The man has to give something of value. The woman has to receive it. What do we use of value today? A ring. Where did that come from? Who made that up? Was that made up? So that is an example of one of the biblical laws that was derived through the 13 hermeneutical principles by the members of the Sanhedrin. The Torah says, "Ki kach ish isha," when a man takes his wife, a woman as his wife. And the Torah doesn't say how to do it. So the rabbis used one of the 13 hermeneutical principles, is called Zera Shava, where they see similar words being used in different contexts and they borrow the way the word is used elsewhere over here. They saw the same word used when Abraham is purchasing a plot of land to bury his beloved wife Sarah on. And by the way, don't get philosophical on me, that's so romantic. It's not. It's law. It's just hardcore legal analysis. And therefore, the way that we get married today is by transferring something over value. It doesn't mean, by the way, a man is purchasing his wife or a couple of camels. A husband does not own his wife. It's merely the legal acquisition. It's the legal methodology through which the two of them are wedded, are betrothed. And when you marry someone like this, you are married to them on the biblical level, even though it was the rabbis, the sages of the Sanhedrin, that arrived at this conclusion. But the reason it's biblical is because it's from the Torah. It's based on a verse in the Torah. As opposed to rabbinic law. Rabbinic law is something that these rabbis actually made up. Who can give me an example of rabbinic law?
Can't have chicken parmesan.
There you go. I don't know if they mentioned chicken parmesan, but I know what you're thinking about. That was very revealing. Okay, the Bible itself says, Lo tevashel gedi b'chalev imo, do not mix the kid in its mother's milk, which means you're not allowed to mix what and what?
Meat.
What kind of meat?
Chicken.
Red meat. Gedi is a kid. It's not a Oh my God, I was about to cock-a-doodle-doo. So why chicken? Why do the rabbis make our lives? It's hard enough not to, you know, have a cheeseburger. So now I can't eat a cheeseburger. What's wrong with chicken parmesan? So the rabbis, now who are the rabbis? Again, it's not Rabbi Joe, and that's where the conservative Orthodox, we could talk about that, comes in a little. What was the reason that they enacted? Everything has a reason, by the way. There's no such thing, oh, they just decide. I woke up one day and I say, let's make life more difficult for the Jews. They're not being oppressed and persecuted enough. Let's make their lives harder. What was the reason they said chicken also?
You could think that you're eating.
Right. It's just, they're just safeguards. Rabbinic laws were either for safeguards or to enhance. What's another safeguard? I'll give you an enhanced one in a minute. What's another safeguard rabbinic law? Give me a Shabbos one.
Oh, different place for session.
That is even... That's like more of even custom. It doesn't even get... What's that?
Not to carry.
Carry is biblical. It's one of the 39 acts of work. But keep going. Good. Not to use money. Not to handle money on Shabbat. Because it might end up... What is it, actually? I think it's because you might come to write, believe it or not. And writing is one of the 39 acts of work. We think maybe you can't write, so to avoid operating with money. It's just the opposite. Writing is one of the 39 acts of work. And therefore, I was going to give another example. And therefore, like this. What if I have this on Shabbat? I walk in, you see me on Saturday morning with a little pen in my pocket. You'd be like, Rabbi, aren't you an Orthodox rabbi? Why are you holding a pen? And I'll say back to you, why can't I hold a pen? I mean, what does the Torah say I can't do? The Torah says don't work. And what is the understanding of work? The 39 acts of work, which is writing. But what about carrying a pen? So the rabbis came along and they said they were concerned. What was their concern? The rabbis are very nervous people. You would inadvertently just take the pen, right? And just like start writing by accident. Now I know what you're thinking. Come on. I'm not so sloppy. I'm a disciplined guy. And I can therefore pick and choose, and a lot of people feel this way, I disagree, but they do, that, you know, I'm a disciplined guy, I know why the rabbis came up with this, I'm disciplined enough not to inadvertently write myself. That's like a guy doing 90 on the freeway, and he gets pulled over by the cop. The cop says, don't you know that the speed limit is 65? He's like, yeah, but I'm a professional streetcar racer. Is there such a thing? I just made that up. I'm a professional streetcar racer, and that 65 was made up, you know, for layman car people. But I'm an expert. And you can't do that. It's a concept in Hebrew called lo plug. You can't have a legal system where it applies to this person, but it doesn't apply to that person. It doesn't work. That's not the way you can have, a functioning society. So the rabbis in general came up with these things, and some people would say, what do you mean? I'm disciplined enough. So that's the concept of rabbinic law. Another rabbinic law, by the way, to enhance. How do you start Shabbos?
Candles.
Where does that come from? The rabbis made it up. Kiddush Friday night. How do you fulfill the mitzvah of Kiddush biblically? No drink. No words. The Torah just says, remember the Sabbath to keep it holy. How do you fulfill the biblical mandate to remember the Sabbath to keep it holy? No rabbis. You just say Shabbat Shalom to someone else. You say, hey, it's Shabbos. I just remembered it was Shabbos. But what are the rabbis? They came along and they say, no. Get some wine, put it in a cup, and say these words. This is what's going to really get you to remember Shabbos. You want to feel some light in your life? Light a candle. If you remove the rabbis from Shabbos, I want you to know, Shabbos would look nothing like it is today. And we would not have been sustained. There's so much that we do. The only biblical things, positively, we do for Shabbat is Kiddush, without the wine, without the cup, without the words, and Havdalah, without the spices, without the flame. All that's rabbinic. So much is rabbinic. You don't even realize. And there's a lot of wisdom. They weren't simply trying to make our lives miserable. They were trying to enrich it with a wholesome kind of feel. You know, I always tell couples when I marry couples, I say, you know, there's some really nice customs and rules and da-da-da, but I'm just going to give you the basics. And they're like, if you strip it down, it's just missing the richness of what has developed our culture and our Judaism for centuries. So this is very, very important. The question is, today, what status does a rabbi have today? And that's a contested issue, still debated pretty vehemently, mostly between the conservative and Orthodox communities. Not really in the Reform, because the Reform doesn't really believe in the binding nature of mitzvot to begin with. Reform ideology always espoused the idea that Judaism is more of a social movement. It's representing ideas. So the idea of keeping of Shabbat is that there should be rest, and there should be peace, there should be tranquility, but it's not like you have to take off from work. It's not like you have to, like, can't get in a car and drive. These are not things, these are not behaviors, these are just ideas. So there's no real room, in a sense, for debating between the Reform and the more traditional elements. It's a little more between the conservative and the Orthodox, and that is, what power does a rabbi have today to change a law or create a new one? So the Orthodox, and I hate using the word Orthodox conservative, because if you ask me what sources I'm using, I don't go to Orthodox rabbis. I go to the Mishnah, I go to the Talmud, I go to sources that go back thousands of years. What do the sources indicate? And the sources seems to indicate pretty clearly that in order to change a pre-existing rabbinic law, you need at least the same stature of court that promulgated the law in the first place. Does that sound familiar? Any legal system has this. If you're convicted of a crime in a district court and you want to appeal it, in America you actually have to do more. You have to go to a higher court that can uproot a lower court's decision. According to Jewish law, all you need is at least the same stature of court. Problem is, who created these laws? The Sanhedrin. Do we have a Sanhedrin? Last time I checked, we got a lot of rabbis, a lot of Jewish things going on, but no Sanhedrin. That's a whole discussion, whether we could reconstitute the Sanhedrin in modernity without the temple, without the Messianic redemption. There's a whole discussion, debate, but we haven't been able to do it. And as long as we don't have a Sanhedrin, we can't really change, according to more traditional Jewish texts and sources, we can't really change or uproot pre-existing, you know, rabbinic legislation, even when it doesn't apply anymore today. Does anybody can think of one practical example of something that doesn't seem to really make sense that we're still doing it today, but we still do it because I think that one of the main reasons we do this is because we don't have the legal apparatus to uproot it. And by the way, if you keep just changing, well, okay, but it doesn't make any more sense, let's just change it anyway, even though then that's just anarchy. And then you're playing with the whole system, and then anything could be changed. Anybody know what I'm talking about? It has to do with Israel versus the diaspora. Why do we keep... Right, so why do we keep 2 days in America, in the diaspora, for the holidays? Let's say Passover, Sukkot, Shavuot. And in Israel, they only keep one day. There's only one Seder in Israel. We do two in America. Why? Anybody know why?
Because of the Wyndham. The word was passed to be safe. They observed it on two, just in case that they didn't do it at the correct time.
Okay, because back when, how was the calendar created back then?
The moon cycle in Israel.
Good. Two people would go into a court of law, testify that they saw the moon was full, and then the Beit Din, the Jewish High Court, would declare, today's Rosh Chodesh, today's the new moon. Oh, today's the new moon. That means in 15 days, if it's the month of Nisan, it's Passover. If it's a new moon and it's the day, it's Tishrei, then it's Sukkot on the 5th. Everything follows that, everything. How would their brethren in the diaspora get the information before email, texts,
shine a light,
and WhatsApp? Now, where were most Jews living during the period of time where they would have to transmit that information? They were living, you mentioned it before, in, where was the Talmud written? They were living in Babel, in Babylonia, which is like modern-day Iraq. So how do you get information from one part of the Middle East to another part of the Middle East? They're not so close to each other, Israel and Iraq. Baruch Hashem. how do they get the information?
I think they shot through the light.
What did they do? They had fires. And we actually have archaeological evidence of the fires, because we know, based on the Mishnah, where the fires took place, and we found them, actually, in Israel. There were certain mountaintops where they built fires, and they would pass on the information. The concern was what? When their brethren in the diaspora got the information, it was a little of a time lag. And now they were nervous that they're not going to be celebrating the holiday, which is based on when Rosh Chodesh was declared as the new moon. We follow the lunar calendar. Are they doing it on the right day? Or are they doing it the day later? So the rabbis, therefore, the Sanhedrin said that if you live in the diaspora, you should keep 2 days of the holiday just in case. Now, does that apply anymore today? How do you figure out what's what in terms of the calendar today? What do? Google? Where does Google get it from? Bank Lumi. I have a Bank Lumi calendar in my office for like 20 years. Every year they send me a calendar. It's a fixed calendar today. We don't come up with our calendar based on people coming into a court of law and testifying the moon is full, right? We don't do that anymore because we don't have a Sanhedrin, we don't have a temple, we don't have any of this apparatus to do it anymore. So why are we still keeping a second day in America, in the diaspora?
Because we don't have the body to change it.
It's just a legal issue.
What about the idea that we don't have to keep spirituality outside of...
Okay, no, some people will like to get a little deeper than that. And they'll say, look, it's not just a legal issue. It's that maybe if we're in the diaspora, we need another day. Israel can get what they can get in 1 day. Here we can get two. What happens when you travel to Israel? You don't live there. You live here. But you go visit some friends on Passover. When in Rome? Or not. So, what are we going to say? What do you think? Right. Unless you really live there or maybe own property there. Or if you go 3 times a year there. You have to have some greater connection to the land.
But today, a lot of American Jews who go to Israel, Sukkot, let's say, they keep 1 day.
I know.
Instead of two. So now...
I had this fight with my brother. And we went together, and I kept the second day and he didn't. And it was a weird time together, I have to say. It was weird. He was walking around in, you know, shorts and a t-shirt, and I was like, with his computer.
Now let's say... Israel,
mostly Yantiv,
he gets on a plane.
Right.
He comes back to America.
Ah.
It's still Yantiv here.
Yeah, it's not so great.
He gets off the plane here.
Right.
On Sukkot, let's say. It's still here.
This is, by the way, Talmud happening right now. This is what the Talmud is.
Yantiv is over in Eretz Yisrael.
Right.
When he gets here, is he allowed to go into shul, daven, and participate in Hakafen?
You got to ask a big rabbi. It's a really good question. I can argue both sides. I can say on one hand, he did the right thing because he was in Israel. And if there are some rabbis who say, even if you don't own property there, you're in Israel when you're in Rome. And I'm seeing more people doing this now. So therefore, maybe it's not inappropriate that he gets on a plane when it's the holiday here, but it's not the holiday there. But when he lands here, it's the holiday.
It's holiday.
It's not so great because he's...
Can he go into shul for
Hakafen? I mean, he can go into shul. He can always go into shul. The question is, which prayer should he say? Should he say a weekday prayer or a holiday prayer? Should he put on tefillin, which are only put on during the week, not on the holidays? A lot of questions. I mean, these are real issues that are discussed. It's a very good question. What's that? Maybe. He maybe shouldn't have flown at all. But, you know, it also depends why you're flying. There could be an emergency. It could be like, you know, maybe not a life-threatening, but a little something, and... Yeah, you hear what's going on? I'm just trying to give you real live examples of things. Yes?
Just a quick question. In terms of, 1,000 years ago, when they were able to, there was more of a system to be able to add things or change things in the law. Is it because, or does it play a role that there are, quote unquote, different sects today?
There were always Jews that argued and differed.
But was there a traditional conservative?
You had a long period of time called the Pharisees and the Sadducees, the Tzedukim, the Perushim, and that was a big controversy that raged for centuries, actually. It wasn't like the conservative reform and Orthodox like today. I don't know if it would matter. You know, the main reason we don't have a Sanhedrin is because we don't have the Mashiach. The Messiah is not here, the temple is not here, all of that. There is one opinion and one reading of the great Maimonides, who we studied last week, that says that if you can get the community to agree on who the 71 greatest scholars are, then you could reconstitute the Sanhedrin even without a temple. and even without the messianic redemption. And that would enable us to then create new laws and maybe even change some pre-existing ones. Only rabbinic, by the way. The rabbis can't come along. I don't care how big of a rabbi. He could be Moses himself. He can't change a biblical law. Okay, we're only talking about rabbinic law now. But if we could somehow reconstitute the Sanhedrin, there was actually a discussion at one point. Those of you who came to Israel with us this past summer, we went to the Rav Yosef Cairo synagogue, and there was discussion in his generation, he lived in the 1500s, about creating a Sanhedrin with him as the head, because he was such a great rabbinic. I also heard murmurings about Rav Adin Steinsatz, who's still alive. He should live and be well. Awesome, awesome scholar, about him trying to get together with some people and seeing if they could put this together. It would be controversial. You wouldn't get an unanimous consensus because a lot of rabbis really believe that the Sanhedrin, where did the Sanhedrin actually sit and adjudicate law? It was in the temple. They were kind of part of the whole temple or apparatus. And whether or not you could split them, you know, is a bit of a controversy also. But some people say you can. So I think that's the way it kind of factors in. Yeah, it's done.
Obviously, I think to some it's like laughable to think that a Sanhedrin could occur, especially without a Sheva. Just logistically, it's impossible. It's just too difficult. But if such a Sanhedrin were to be created hypothetically, they couldn't go back on previous Sanhedrin.
That's a very good question. Well, they would have to really analyze, let's say, the two-day thing. Let's say that was really annoying people and they wanted to change that one. Okay? They'd have to figure out who was the group of rabbis that promulgated that law, and is the current group at least the same stature? They don't have to be greater. They have to be at least in equal stature.
What about the concept of, let's call it, I feel like a better term, I'm very tired, but like Nisaric spiritual depletion?
It's called Nistaklu Hadarot, that the generations descend.
Right.
There is such an idea. Right, so I want to read a story with you that actually speaks to this. If you can turn to page 8, because we're getting a little late here. There is that idea that is the further we get away from Sinai, the more hazy things become. But there's another trend that goes against that, which is the more we study, the more we learn, the more sophisticated and developed Judaism becomes too. And I want to share a story with you. Actually, two stories. Oh, okay, it's a little late. This is an amazing story. Let's go to page 9. Let's go to page 9, because it really touches on your question. Rabbi Yehuda, in the name of Rav, when Moses ascended on high, look on the bottom of page 9. This is a story from the Talmud. You need to use a little imagination for the story. Okay, is with me? Page 9 on the bottom. It's source number 10. Rabbi Yehuda, in the name of Rab, said, when Moses ascended on high, he found the Holy One, blessed is he, engaged in affixing coronets to the letters. Does anybody ever see a coronet to a letter in a Torah scroll? You ever see the way certain Hebrew letters are written in the Torah? They look like little crowns on top. If I had a Torah scroll, I could open it up and show you what I'm talking about. But you ever watch a sofer? Ooh, a sofer, a scribe. When will you get an opportunity to actually see a scribe? It's going to be sitting right here. Did I mention we have a shot in the sky? Sitting right over here. So the scribe, these guys are writing, a lamed is not just the way we might have learned to write a lamed in Hebrew school. It's a whole squiggly little thing with crowns. Moses is on Sinai. He's seeing God affixing coronets to the letters. And he says, God, who stays thy hand? And he says, there will arise a man, God says to Moshe, at the end of it, many generations. His name is Akiva ben Yosef, who will expound upon each tittle heaps of laws. God says to Moshe, there's going to be such an awesome scholar who's going to one day live many years in the future. His name? Akiva. The famous Rabbi Akiva. Who, by the way, only started learning about Judaism at the age of 40. We like to talk about him a lot here at MJE, even though we're for 20s and 30s. Anyway, so he says, Lord of the God, permit me to see him. Moshe's like, I want to see him. You know, time, space, these are little details if you have a relationship with God. So he replied, turn thee around. Moses went and sat down behind 8 rows. and listen to the discourses upon the law. Moshe Rabbeinu was transported in a time machine into 1,000 years later, in the Roman period when Rabbi Akiva lived, and he sat in the 8th row of Rabbi Akiva's class. Not being able to follow their arguments, he was ill at ease. But when they came to a certain subject, and the disciples said to their master, "Whence do you know it?" Remember I said you're supposed to always ask your teacher, "How do you know this? Where do you know this from?" And the latter replied, "It is a law given unto Moshe at Sinai." He was comforted. Thereupon he returned to the Holy One, blessed is He, and said, "Lord of the universe, thou hast such a man, and thou givest the Torah by me." Moshe was so humble. He was so humble, and he sat in Rabbi Akiva's classroom. So a couple of questions. What does that mean? He's sitting in the class. He doesn't follow what's going on. How is that Moshe Rabbeinu can't follow the class?
Different language.
Different language. They were speaking in Roman? Latin? What were they talking? What language were they using? Now, it means that he wasn't able to follow what was going on. And then he became upset. And then all of a sudden, one of the students asked the teacher, Rabbi Akiva, "How do you know this? Where do you know this from?" And he answers, "Halacha l'Moshe m'Sinai. It's a law given over from God to Moses at Sinai, like the color black for tefillin." And now Moshe feels comforted now. "Oh, I feel better." And then he turns to Hashem and he says, "You have such a scholar like Rabbi Akiva and you chose to give the Torah through me? Why me? What's happening here? Why couldn't Moshe understand what was going on?" Moshe couldn't understand what was going on because 1,000 years had transpired since he brought down the Torah. The Torah isn't this fixed thing. Like here's the book that God told me to write down here. And then if 1,000 years later, it's the same book. You should follow everything that's in there. But the oral tradition develops and becomes more and more sophisticated. And yes, the concept of Nistaklu HaDarot, the further we get from Sinai, the more hazy certain things become. Hang on one second. Let me just finish the point. On the other hand, the more we develop the Torah, and the more sophisticated, in a sense, the Torah becomes. And hence, Moshe couldn't even understand exactly what was going on in the class. And he's like, "Is this the same Torah that I helped bring down?" And then finally, he hears Halacha l'Moshe m'Sinai. He realizes, no, this is part of the Torah I brought down, but it's 1,000 years later. 1,000 years of stuff, excuse me, has happened. And they have to apply this Torah to new situations and new scenarios of life. It's going to develop. It's not going to change. It's going to develop. And that's what we're doing. And you asked before, you know, is it the same? Can the Talmud continue? Of course the Talmud's continuing. The Talmud's continuing right here, because if somebody in this room comes up with a great insight and a deeper way of understanding something and applies it to a current day situation differently than it was in the past, you've developed the Torah. Maybe you haven't added a word in the Torah. And by the way, you're not supposed to do that because the Torah is what it is. It's 613 commandments. We don't want 614 and we don't want 612. It's a recipe. It's perfect. But our understanding of it becomes more developed and more sophisticated over the years. And that's why Moshe couldn't understand it. And that's why he is sort of at peace when he realizes, yeah, but this is all based on the very same principles that he was able to bring down from Sinai and give over to the people initially. We are taking those same principles, we are learning them, and we're developing them more and more deeply. And that's what happens in yeshiva. Like, why continue to study something if our ancestors studied it 1,000 years? Let's just read what they wrote. You want to make Torah yours, you got to grapple with it, you got to figure it out, and you got to make it applicable and relevant to your life. That's the way this is going to stay alive. That's the reason we're still thriving today. If it was a book collecting dust on a shelf that we could just pick it up and just read what was written thousands of years ago without any more development in terms of who we are and what we bring to the table, I don't think we'd be around anymore.
That's through a very delicate, locking process. That's
correct. It's not saying or doing anything you want. You know what I mean? It's not like, well, I feel today, you know, I'm done with that mitzvah.
Right, let's do the judges of our time, so to speak.
Exactly. And that's why you need real leadership. You need real leadership and you need tremendous scholarship as well at the same time. But there's a lot given over to us. Let me do one last source, and then we're going to finish up. Turn the page before. There's another great story in the Talmud. Rabbi Elazar ruled, top of the page, page 8. Rabbi Elazar ruled that a certain object was ritually pure, and the sages ruled it was ritually impure. It's from the Talmud. There was a debate between two rabbis about, I don't want to get into it, but there's a whole thing called Tumah v'Tahara in the Torah. Tameh means ritually impure. Let's say you touch a body, a dead body, excuse me, a corpse. You become ritually impure. You would need to go into the mikvah. Different types of things, certain emissions from the body could render you ritually impure. Anyway, so there was a certain object that was ritually pure, and the sages ruled that that particular object was ritually impure. On that day, Rabbi Elazar offered every imaginable argument to support his ruling, and the sages did not accept him. And he said, you know, if I'm right, if the halacha is in accordance with my view, halacha means the law, then let this carob tree serve as a proof. Now, by the way, what happens if you have one sage arguing with a group of sages? Who do you follow? You follow the group, because the Torah says, and this is where the world got the idea of majority rules. Acharei rabim lahatot. So Rabbi Elazar, though, really, you knew he was going to lose this thing because he was all alone. So he's like, you know what? I'll prove to you that I'm correct and you're wrong. If I'm correct, let this carob tree serve as a proof. And what happened? Miraculously, the carob tree became uprooted. It moved 100 cubits on its own. It's like a weird thing. The sages came back and said, you can't derive a proof from a carob tree. And he then said, let this stream of water prove that the halacha is in accordance with my opinion. Whereupon the stream of water began to flow backwards. The sages said, you can't bring a proof from a stream. He said, let the walls of the study hall serve as a proof. And the walls of the study hall buckled, about to fall. Rabbi Yehoshua then rebuked, another rabbi who was there, rebuked the walls. He started talking to the walls. He says, what right do you have to intervene when sages argue about halacha? Stay out of this argument, you wall. So the walls did not fall in deference to Rabbi Yehoshua, but they didn't straighten up because Rabbi Elazar told the walls to buckle. It's a bizarre Gemara. Right, whereupon Rabbi Elazar said, let the heavens prove, like the stream, the this, everything he says to God. You know what? I'm going to bring God into this conversation. Let God prove that I'm correct. A voice from heaven proclaimed, why do you argue with my son Eliezer when the halacha accords with his view? God involves himself. A bat kol, a heavenly voice, rings out and says, Rabbi Elazar is correct. And just because you're a group doesn't mean you're right. He's correct. What did the rabbis say? Rabbi Yehoshua stood up and declared, I'm going to say it in Hebrew and then I'll translate, it's a very, lo bashamayim hi. What does it say in the Torah? The Torah is not in the heavens. It used to be in the heavens, but now it's ours. What did he mean? Rabbi Yirmiyahu says, once the Torah was given at Sinai, we pay no heed to heavenly voices. For it says in the Torah, you shall follow the majority. Right? Judaism is not a bunch of supernatural kind of things that you wait for God to come out. God gave us a Torah and He said, here are the rules, here are the laws, figure it out yourself. And the majority in this case differs with Rabbi Elazar. So they basically told God, stay out of it. This has nothing to do with you. Even though they were arguing over what to do from a Torah perspective. Rav Nassan later met the prophet Eliyahu, the prophet Elijah. And he asked him, what did God do when Rabbi Yeshua made this the chutzpah for a rabbi to turn to God and say, thank you for your opinion, but lo b'shamayim hi, the Torah is not in the heavens. Excuse me, we're figuring out, we're in the Beit Midrash, we're in the study hall, we'll get the answer, thank you very much. What was Hashem's reaction, the Talmud concludes? He said, God smiled and said, my sons have defeated me. That's exactly what God wants. We don't look for miracles to figure out what to do in life. We have this thing called the Torah. It's not always clear what the Torah means all the time. That's why we have the oral tradition. And the oral tradition isn't always clear, and there'll be arguments and debates. But as long as you stay within the system, whatever answer you come out with is, we believe, what God wants. Even though we don't really know if God's saying this, that, or the other. But that's what Hashem wants us to do. He wants us to be partners in this whole thing, and not simply robots. Follow along at the last page here. Once the Torah was given, this is a book written by Rabbi Nathan Lopez Cardoza, amazing rabbi, Shalom be well, lives in Israel, and he wrote that once the Torah was given at Sinai, God wanted man to interpret it without paying attention to supernatural intervention. To be sure, there are rules governing this interpretation, but as long as you explain the Torah in a manner consistent with these axioms, man can determine the law with complete confidence that his rulings are acceptable. In a sense, God has limited his right to intervene in the halachic process. He prefers orderly legal procedures to miracles and heavenly voices. Were supernatural phenomena allowed to influence the decision of halacha, the entire structure of Torah study, the pillar upon which all of Judaism rests, would collapse. If you remove the sage's ability to interpret the law, and you render the debates and dialogues of the Talmud meaningless, the sage's right to determine the halacha must be independent of divine negation if Judaism is to be an ever-fresh and dynamic way of life. The episode recounted was a test. Had the sages agreed to accept Rabbi Eliezer's opinion because of the voice from heaven, they would have misunderstood the basis of the revelation, that the Torah is not in heaven. Everything man needs to know concerning the Torah was given to him at Sinai. It's our responsibility to use this knowledge, to use these tools, to develop the system of living the Torah demands. Okay, we're going to stop here if that's okay. Next week, what I want to do with you guys, and if you want to read ahead a little, read on page 10, The Sanctity of Human Life, Can You Sacrifice One Life to Save Another? We're going to talk about that case of the Dicephalese twins. I would also like to talk about cosmetic surgery and what the halacha has to say. I'm just picking interesting areas that are really sort of modern things to demonstrate how halacha can be used to help us navigate these complicated and important areas. Can a person just, put themselves under the knife to make themselves look a little better or much better? And then I'm going to talk about another situation that I had when I was in law school, and I worked in the extradition department in Israel, and a whole prohibition of extraditing a fellow Jew to serve who's been accused of committing a crime, and how Israel and or anyone who wants to be halachic can still do that and live in the modern world. That's what we're going to do in the next 2 weeks. We're going to attack some of these real life situations and continue to clarify this. If anybody has questions, by the way, during the week, I know I'm sending out homework, and you guys have been great in answering the questions. I'm really impressed with your responses. If anybody has questions, you can just get in touch with me. Shoot me an email. Love to get on the phone for 5-6 minutes, clarify something, listen to this, or just whatever. I'm around. I'd love to talk during the week about this material as well. Hope to see you guys in Shabbat and on Sunday. Did I mention we were having a... Yeah, I think so. I'm not going to talk about that anymore. Have a great night, everyone. You got a little break. Who's teaching the fellows now? Does anyone know? Okay. Maybe it's finished. Oh, Adina, she's tonight?
Yeah.
Okay, cool.